We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present, unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future, on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio, January 31, 2016, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network, every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. And once again, we have got a doubleheader coming up here tonight. After Dark Radio followed immediately by Dragon King Dark with Carl Stern. He is one of the other podcasts that air every week up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. You can always hear the doubleheader here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. If you want to download the shows, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. What do we got coming up tonight? Pew Eatwell is our guest. She was born in India of mixed Anglo-Indian descent, studied English at Oxford University, graduating with a starred first-class degree, fourth out of all students taking the final exam. Her first book, They Eat Horses, Don't They? The Truth About the French, won the Next Generation Indie Award for Nonfiction, was the Daily Mail and the Times Book of the Week. Her second book, which we're going to be talking about today, a historical mystery about a famous Edwardian trial called The Dead Duke, His Secret Wife, and The Missing Corpse. The Dead Duke was an Amazon bestseller. In the categories of legal history and true crime, was included in the Amazon and Goodreads Best Book of the Month for October 2015, and was nominated for Best History Book of the Year in the Goodreads Reader's Choice Awards 2015. Her next French-themed book, F is for France, A Curious Cabinet of French Wonders, is coming out in April of 2016, published by St. Martin's Press. Currently working on a new historical nonfiction book to be published in 2017. Pew Eatwell is going to be our guest on the show today, and we have a lot of stuff to talk to her about. As noted, when this show ends, After Dark Radio is going to be followed by Dragon King Dark with Carl Stern. He's got a very interesting show as well. And as noted, you can head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com and download this and listen to it at your convenience after the show is over. He'll be talking about the Sloss Furnace. What is the Sloss Furnace? It is now a historical site in Birmingham, Alabama. And every Halloween, the location of one of the state's most successful and long-running haunted attractions, Sloss Furnace, is a real history of horror and death. Carl will be joined by his wife as they discuss their multiple trips to Sloss Furnace, discuss the horrible history of the steel mill, and the accounts and documentaries focusing and discussing its place among the most haunted places in America. You will hear Carl and his wife's firsthand accounts of being inside the tunnel, which according to various documentaries is one of the most haunted places on Earth. And there's a photo that you can see up right now at AfterDarkRadioShow.com of the Sloss Furnace. So head up there and check that out. That show's going to be airing immediately after this program here tonight. Now, before we go to the interview with Pew Eatwell, I want to talk about a couple of different things. A couple of stories caught my eye this week. One of them here from mysteriousuniverse.org. Taxi drivers report picking up ghosts from the 2011 tsunami. Now, we hear ghost stories all the time, and this one caught my eye because this story here by Paul Seaburn, this is not just stories, but this is somebody who actually did his thesis on this topic. A sociology student in Japan interviewed taxi drivers for a thesis and found that a number of them reported picking up ghosts after the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami. Where were they going? Are ghosts good tippers? Quote, have I died? That is not the kind of comment taxi drivers expect to hear from a fare. That's just one of the eerie comments drivers working in Ishinomaki related to this student, Yuka Kudo. About 6,000 residents died as a result of the 2011 disaster, making one of the hardest hit areas and the reason why Yuka chose it for her study. She asked a question, do you have any unusual experiences after the disaster? She asked over 100 drivers during her year of research. She reported responses from indifference to anger, but seven drivers willingly shared their chilling experiences with ghosts. One driver said he picked up a young man in his 20s and asked where he wanted to go. The man kept pointing ahead and repeating Hiyoriyama, which means mountain. Hiyoriyama. When he got there, the young man had disappeared from the back seat. Another driver picked up a young woman who told him that she wanted to go to an area that was deserted. When the driver pointed this out to her, she asked, have I died? When he looked over his shoulder, the girl was gone. Kudo heard similar stories from the other drivers, who considered them to be spiritual experiences. In each case, they verified their stories by showing her records that they had started their meters, which meant they were responsible for collecting a fare they instead had to pay out of their own pockets when the riders vanished. Why would drivers start their meters if they didn't think the passenger was a real person? What is soon-to-be sociologist Yuka Kudo make of these accounts? She seems to believe that they were definitely ghosts of young adults who perished in the disaster. Young people feel strongly chagrined at their deaths when they cannot meet people they love. As they want to convey their bitterness, they may have chosen taxis, which are like private rooms, as a medium to do so. Now, of course, if you have ever heard the story of the vanishing hitchhiker, this likely sounds familiar. One of the oldest urban legends, and as a kid, long before you could go on the internet and read Snopes, for example, there were these books by Jan Harold Brunvand. There was The Vanishing Hitchhiker, there was The Choking Doberman, there were a lot of them. And I love these books, read them cover to cover. The Vanishing Hitchhiker was the title of the first one that I read. I still have it to this day. And it's a very, very famous urban legend. There's a million variations of it. And here is a typical example. This from, yes, Snopes.com. A dozen miles out of Baltimore, the main road from New York, route number one, is crossed by another important highway. It is a dangerous intersection, and there is talk of building an underpass for the East-West Road. To date, however, the plans only exist on paper. This, by the way, is a vanishing hitchhiker story that was collected, I believe, on the internet around 1998. It says, Dr. Eckersall was driving home from a country club dance late one Saturday night. He slowed up for the intersection and was surprised to see a lovely young girl dressed in the sheerest of evening gowns, beckoning him for a lift. He jammed on his brakes and motioned for her to climb into the back seat of his roadster. All cluttered up with golf clubs and bags up here in front, he explained. But what on earth is a youngster like you doing out here, all alone, at this time of night? It's too long a story to tell you now, said the girl. Her voice was sweet and somewhat shrill, like the tinkling of sleigh bells. Please, she said, Please take me home. I'll explain everything there. The address is such and such on North Charles Street. I do hope it's not too far out of your way. The doctor grunted and set the car in motion. He drove rapidly to the address she had given him, and as he pulled up before the shuttered house, he said, "Here we are." And then he turned around, and the back seat was empty. "What the devil?" the doctor muttered to himself. The girl couldn't possibly have fallen from the car, nor could she simply have vanished. He rang insistently on the house bell, confused as he had never been in his life before. At long last, the door opened. A gray-haired, very tired-looking man peered out at him. "I can't tell you what an amazing thing has happened," began the doctor. "A young girl gave me the address a while back. I drove here, and..." "Yes, yes, I know," said the old man wearily. "This has happened several other Saturday evenings in the past month. That young girl, sir, was my daughter. She was killed in an automobile accident at that intersection where you saw her almost 2 years ago." Now, right there is a classic example of the vanishing hitchhiker. There have been other examples. There's a story of the guy that picks up the hitchhiker that looks like Jesus, and the guy talks about the end day, says the end is coming, the guy turns around, the guy is gone. There's a million variations of this, and it goes back probably forever. Probably as long as there have been stories, there's some sort of example of the famous vanishing hitchhiker urban legend. But I thought it was very interesting, having heard that legend so many times, to then read about somebody who did a thesis on it based on taxi drivers and people who had allegedly, I guess, wanted a ride after passing away in that 2011 earthquake. We've also got this, weekandweird.com. If you never checked it out, head over there, weekandweird.com. Somebody sent an email to them, I guess, and the story scared the hell out of people. And so it's After Dark Radio. I'm going to read it here on the air. If you want to check out the original, it is up right now at weekandweird.com. Some of you may have heard the stories of the black-eyed children. It's an urban legend, I guess. Guess it's an urban legend now. But many people have told these stories and heard these stories. I'm going to read this one to you. This is one of many. You'll see them. They'll ask for a ride, or they'll ask to be led into your home. They seem like perfectly normal children until you get a little closer and you notice their eyes are completely black. People are terrified. They run away. And the story is, do not let them in your car. Do not let them into your house. Don't have anything to do with these black-eyed children. If you see them, run! Slam the door! Well, here's somebody that claims they let the black-eyed children into their home. Here is the email. "Let me start by saying that I know how hard this all will be to believe, but now that things have taken a turn for the worse, I started looking for stories similar to mine and found Weak and Weird. I feel like I should share this story with someone, and your website seems like the right place. I made the mistake of letting the black-eyed kids inside, and now I'm worried that I might die because of it. I hope that this will be a warning to everyone who is ever in the position to make the same mistake that I did. I live just outside of a rural town in Vermont. It is a tight-knit community where everyone knows one another, and people don't lock their doors at night. There has never been any need to. A little over a year ago, I woke up because I heard a loud banging on my front door. At the time, my husband and I lived in a small home on a dirt road just off the rural route into town. It was the middle of a snowstorm, and the nearby hills get very slippery in the snow, so I thought that someone might have been in an accident and broken down. It's happened before. When I looked out the window, I could see that our motion spotlight was on. I could see that there were footprints in the snow that had come from our road and into our driveway, but there was no car anywhere. The snow was still covering the road, and no one had driven on it for at least a couple of hours. Our front door was obscured from the window, but I could see that someone was standing there. I wasn't sure what to think, so I woke my husband up just to feel safer. While I was telling him what was going on, the banging on the door started again, and my husband went to answer it while I stood in the hallway. When he opened the door, there were two children standing in the snow, looking toward the ground. They were a boy and a girl, and could not have been more than 8 years old. They were dressed strangely and had odd haircuts. The girl's hair was very long and straight, and the boy had a dated haircut that looked almost like a bowl cut. They weren't dressed for winter, and my first thought was that they must have been Mennonite children. But as far as I know, there was never a large community of Mennonites near us. Thinking back on it, I know that my normal reaction to seeing children in a snowstorm would have been to rush them inside and bundle them up with some blankets and hot cocoa. But that is not how this felt. The children were very unnerving. They would not make eye contact, and when my husband asked them if everything was okay, they asked if they could come in. My husband looked at me like, "What do I do?" And I asked the parents, or the kids, where their parents were. "They'll be here soon," is all they said. It was around 2 o'clock in the morning at this point, so the only reasonable thought in my head was that there must have been an accident, or these kids got lost. As much as my instincts told me not to bring them inside, I did it anyway. I went into the kitchen to make them some hot cocoa while my husband took them into the living room. While I was fixing the kettle, I could hear my husband talking to the kids. He was asking them if they were okay, where they came from, how far they walked, if their parents' car was broken down, things like that. But they always answered, "Our parents will be here soon." They spoke in a sing-songy voice. They weren't afraid to be in our stranger's home at all, a stranger's home. Started to notice that our cats, we had four, were all hiding, except Pigeon, who was in the kitchen with me. Normally, our cats are very curious and friendly, and we have to be careful that they don't run out the door when we leave. This time, none of them even tried to see who was here, which I thought was very strange. All of the hair on Pigeon's neck was standing up, and his tail was puffed up while she looked into the living room. When I bent down to pet them and see what was wrong, she hissed and started growling and backed up until she had hid herself under the kitchen island. I have never seen her do that before. When I walked back into the living room, the kids were sitting on the couch, as still as can be, but my husband was holding his head in his hands. I asked him what was wrong, and he just said that he felt very dizzy all of a sudden, but that he was fine. I turned back to the children to give them their cocoa, but when they looked at me, I gasped. It took everything inside of me not to drop the mugs and run away. When they looked at me, their eyes were completely black. They had no whites, just giant black pupils. When they saw that I was scared, they stood up and asked if they could use the bathroom. I tried to be as composed as I could be and showed them down the hall. They went into the bathroom together, and I hurried back to my husband to ask him if he had seen their eyes. He had seen them, and he said it looked like his brother's badly bruised eyes after a car accident. We were in the middle of talking about whose children they could be when my husband's nose started to bleed. He's never had nosebleeds as long as I had known him. I just knew inside myself that this had something to do with the kids in the bathroom, and I started crying while I ran to get my husband some tissues. That's when the power went out. I heard my husband yell my name from the living room, and as I started to walk back through the hallway, I stopped dead in my tracks. The two children were standing at the end of the hallway. They weren't moving, and I have never been so scared in my whole life. They just stood there in the dark. After what felt like forever, the boy said, "Our parents are here." And they walked to the door, opened it, and walked out, leaving it wide open. My husband jumped up to go close it and almost fell over. We looked out the window and saw two men standing by a black car idling at the end of our driveway. The men looked like they were wearing black-colored suits and were very tall, at least 6 feet. When my husband waved at them, they just stared at us, got into the car, and drove off. Our power came on about a half hour later, but nothing was the same after that. Over the next few months, three of our cats went missing. We can only assume that they ran away somewhere and never came back, but the worst thing was coming home to find Pigeon in a puddle of blood on the living room floor. Looked like she'd been vomiting blood. The vet told us some sort of hemorrhage. After my husband's nosebleeds became a regular occurrence, he went to see the doctor. He didn't know what to make of it other than dry nasal passages. But my husband was diagnosed with an aggressive skin cancer. When the doctor asked us if he used tanning beds, we both thought he was joking. But apparently, This kind of melanoma is linked to overuse of indoor tanning. The doctors think he will recover, but don't understand how it got so bad so quickly. My husband has never worked an outdoor job, spends relatively little time in the sun. Since we let the black-eyed kids into our home, I've also suffered from regular dizzy spells and nosebleeds on a regular basis. I've had other issues, which I won't mention here, but trust me when I say I am suddenly in the worst condition of my life, and no one could do anything about it. I know that all of this is because I let the black-eyed children into my home. We've told everyone we could about the strange kids that showed up that night, but no one else saw them, and some laugh at how scared we were of the Mennonite kids. But we know what we saw. I wish my husband had never opened the door. Feel free to publish this as a warning to others about the black-eyed kids. My advice would be to lock your doors, call the police, and wait for morning. Don't make the same mistake that I did. Whole letter is up right now if you want to check it out at weekandweird.com. And if you're not freaked out enough, or you want to know more, you can always head up to the internet and Google black-eyed children, and you'll find everything that you ever wanted to know or ever didn't want to know about the black-eyed kids. Do not let them in. Got an email here, much less terrifying, but strange. It is from Jake. If you want to email me, by the way, the website is afterdarkradioshow.com, and if you scroll down on the left-hand side of the page, there's all the information you need. I am Brian at afterdarkradioshow.com. Carl Stern of Dragon King Dark is Carl at dragonkingcarl.com. Guest booking, you can contact Kenneth Nita at gmail.com. That's Kenneth Nita at gmail.com. My Twitter at Brian Alvarez, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. Make sure you head up there. Facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. You can follow us there. We'll be sending you probably 3 news stories a day. Very fascinating stories. Andrew Ludsky is the curator of that site. He's the one that sends everything. He will not bombard your email with stories. You'll usually get about 3 a day. So check it out. Afterdarkradioshow.com and Facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. You can also message Andrew as well, and he can get your information to Kenneth. If you'd like to be a guest, or you think you know somebody who would be a great guest for this program, always looking for guests, although we are booked up solid through all of February, so we got a lot of great shows upcoming. This email here is from Jake. He says, I try my best to listen to the show every week via the podcast. I'm not a believer in the paranormal or conspiracy, like Bigfoot, for example, but I very much enjoy the show. Wanted to share a series of dreams and nightmares that I've had recently. Perhaps it can open a discussion on air or for a future guest. Jake says, on 3 occasions to date, while sleeping, I have encountered what I can only best describe as fear. The scene most likely takes place in my bedroom, where fear is trying to overcome or possess me. In the dream, I know fear is there, but I can't see it. I just feel its presence. I try to fight back, often getting up and goading it in an attempt to survive its onslaught. I can feel my heart racing and pounding through the entire event, and normally I forcibly wake myself after some struggle. The last dream of such a nature saw me lose, and I felt myself be lifted up to the ceiling of my room and being spun around. I felt that happening and indeed saw or believe that such a thing was occurring. The kicker, he says, of the 3 occasions that I've had this experience, 2 of them happened while listening to your show as I went to sleep. Thank you for taking the time to read my email, both for the After Dark and Wrestling Observer work you do. That is Jake in the UK. Jake, you need to email Carl. Carl Stern, who is Carl at DragonKingCarl.com. You probably have heard it by now. If you haven't, they're in the archives at WrestlingObserver.com. Carl has done a show on fear. It is something that he has been fascinated by. He's done a lot of great podcasts talking about it, one in particular that was all about fear. Might be something you may want to listen to. Maybe that was one of the shows you were listening to when you had this experience, if you've ever listened to this live and you might have heard Carl's show. So head up there and email Carl, carl@dragonkingcarl.com. I've never really done a show on fear, but maybe I need to do that down the road. Obviously, stories like The Black Eyed Kids, all about fear. But I want to thank you very much for that email. And again, if you want to email me, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com, and check out Carl's archives at wrestlingobserver.com to learn more about his thoughts on fear. Pew Eatwell was born in India, studied English at Oxford University. She is the author of a number of books, two of which we're going to be talking about today. One of them, They Eat Horses, Don't They? The Truth About the French, and we'll spend more time on The Dead Duke, His Secret Wife, and The Missing Corpse, a true historical crime mystery, which you're going to find very interesting. Pew Eatwell is our guest today, and we'll be back in just a moment with her, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Pew Eatwell. We're going to be talking a number of different subjects today. Two books that we can talk about. The Dead Duke, His Secret Wife, and The Missing Corpse, as well as They Eat Horses, Don't They? Two completely different topics. Pew, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you.
I want to actually start with the book about They Eat Horses, Don't They? Which I believe is the full title of the book right here. I believe this is the first one that you wrote, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
So, you essentially, I guess, went and lived in France for a decade, and I guess you got upset about all of these stories that you always hear, or that people, I guess, visiting France would assume about the French that were absolutely not true. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. I've lived in France for 10 years now, and I really, over the period I've lived here, began to get very annoyed about all these ideas that people have about the French, that, for example, all French women are really slim and glamorous, all French food is amazing. Of course, there is some truth to quite a lot of these myths, but also a lot of them simply aren't true, and I just felt that they weren't particularly helpful to an understanding of what France is really like. And I think to some degree the world realizes that every so often as well. Like, for example, obviously we just had these recent terror attacks, and then suddenly everyone jolts up and sits up and goes, oh, well, actually, hang on a minute. Maybe it's not all so perfect in France.
I have a friend named Celian, and he lives in France. And I see him maybe once a year, and I wouldn't even really call him heavy. He weighs maybe 210 pounds or something like that. But every time I see him, he says, I'm the fattest man in all of France. And suffice to say, I have plenty of friends that are much fatter than Celian. And so, I was in France once when I was young. I went on a high school trip. But there does seem to be that belief that people in America are much, much, much fatter than people in France. I don't know if necessarily the belief here is that everyone is really, really skinny, but I was surprised when he said that he was the fattest guy in France, because I didn't believe that could possibly be true.
Well, I think in general terms, I would have to agree that Americans are overall fatter than the average French person. I'm certainly surprised when I was just in Los Angeles recently researching a new book, and I was quite surprised at the size of some of the people I saw walking around the street. If you had people that big walking around the street in Paris, people would stare. But on the other hand, it is a complete myth to say that all French women, or indeed all French people, are incredibly slim and glamorous. That idea is very much based on the view of the average, say, American tourist who will come to Paris, usually the most expensive districts of Paris, such as the 6th arrondissement, where, of course, all the glamorous women hang out, and then come back and say, oh, well, of course, that's how all French women are, which is a bit like saying, you know, all American women look like the women you see shopping on Rodeo Drive. I mean, it's just ridiculous. If you look outside of Paris, and in particular areas such as the northeast, women are much bigger. And in fact, you know, they're nothing like the kind of stereotypical images that we have of French women.
Now, don't get mad at me, because this was 25 years ago. But as noted, I went to France on a school trip. And when I got there, the first thing I did was I bought a beret because I thought that's what French people wear. And sure enough, I was the only guy in France wearing a beret. That was, I shouldn't say that. There was nobody in France wearing a beret that was actually from France that I ran into. Everybody I ran into was actually an American wearing a beret, or Americans that came up to me that thought I was a Frenchman because I was wearing a beret, but they were not worn all over the place in France. What are some of the common, I guess, myths that you write about in your book? I guess the beret might be one.
Absolutely, yes, and you're completely right. I mean, that, again, was an idea I had when I came to France. And in fact, I remember I bought myself a beret thinking, oh, goodness, you know, I shall stroll along the streets in Paris wearing this and feel really French. And then I got the shock of my life because, as you say, the only people I saw wearing berets were essentially tourists, or if you go up to Montmartre in the 18th, there's a very touristy little square where all the painters sit, and a few of them dress up in striped shirts and berets because they know that that's going to attract all the tourists. But, you know, the average French person would not be seen dead wearing a beret because it's just too cliched. And in fact, you know, the last beret-making company, traditional beret-making company in France, recently more or less just collapsed. Because there just isn't the business now, particularly that the U.S. Army, which used to be one of the main markets for berets, and in fact has more or less discontinued them. So it is very much one of the cliches of France that isn't true.
I am looking at the cover here. There is essentially it's just you see a sweater, I guess it is. And you see a beret, and that's all that you see on this, I guess, imaginary French person. And it is interesting because when you look at it, I mean, you could show that to anybody and you could say, what does this represent? And they would say somebody from France. But in reality, that's just not the case. That would maybe be someone from France who was visiting.
Absolutely. Absolutely, absolutely. And the same with the striped T-shirt, which you see on the cover. It's another cliche. It originated with fishermen, French fishermen, and it was, in fact, adapted by Coco Chanel. I mean, that was how the striped shirt became world famous. Coco Chanel went on a holiday and saw these French fishermen wearing their striped T-shirts, and she thought, what a great idea. I'm going to take that idea and adapt it. And so from then, it's traveled all around the world, and it's, of course, now the signature of Jean-Paul Gaultier or Gaultier's perfumes and so on. He's got the striped T-shirt. And it's become this enormous cliche. But again, if you walk along the street looking at the average French person, it's very, very rare to see anybody wearing a striped T-shirt. It tends to be something that's more kept for children. In particular, Petit Bateau, the children's brand, have got a famous fisherman's coat with a striped lining. But you would never, the average French adult would not be seen dead wandering about the streets of Paris wearing a striped T-shirt.
Now, when we talk about myths here, are some of these things that, I mean, you mentioned that French fishermen originally wore this outfit and it was seen and then it became whatever. I mean, are some of these beliefs, do they have a factual basis in the past, but it was something that, I mean, maybe it was popular 50 years ago, 100 years ago, whatever, and you don't see it at all today, but it sort of caught on and now people believe that still in 2016, this is true?
Yeah, absolutely. That's completely the case. A very good example is, for example, the myth that French people don't wash, which is a very sort of widespread myth. And that really has its origins. That's a myth you can date very specifically. It has its origins in the American GIs coming to France at the end of the Second World War. And you had a situation at that time when America was relatively advanced in terms of sanitation and supplies and piping and so on. And France was at that point a very, very rural country where most people would maybe have a shower in the village fountain once every couple of years. And so you had this direct confrontation between two very different cultures. And the GIs all went back home saying, oh, my God, those French people, they don't wash, and so on and so forth. And this became a huge myth. And, of course, now it's completely non-applicable. French sanitation and plumbing is easily equivalent to anywhere else in the modern world. And so the myth just doesn't apply. But it somehow stuck. It's a kind of historical incident which became a worldwide myth and which is still in currency today.
Now, one more on this topic here. The actual title of the book, They Eat Horses, Don't They? I never heard that one. And maybe just, I don't know, maybe I just never heard about it growing up. I presume it's much more widespread than it is. How did this one come about?
Well, the myth that the French eat horses, to some degree, is true because horse meat is eaten in France. And of course, it's not eaten, at least it's not knowingly eaten in Britain and America. But the consumption, the rate of consumption has gone down massively. Horse meat essentially was introduced in the 19th century in France, and it was considered a poor man's meat. And it was really a sort of beef substitute for people who couldn't afford to buy beef. And over the 20th century, the rates have gone down enormously. And whilst you still do have horse butchers in France, you do even occasionally see them in Paris. There's one in the 15th arrondissement just down the road from me. You know it's a horse butcher's because it will have a horse's head on the front of the on the front door. But it's still much, much lower than it was in the past. And it's really just only a few pockets, mainly the older generation who still eat horse meat.
And also, I want to just go back very quickly and just say that a little bit of confusion. The cover of the book that I was talking about with the beret is actually your next book coming out. F is for France. I believe that's coming out in...
That's right, yes. I was actually about to clarify that.
yeah, I'm confused.
They Eat Horses, Don't They? Was my first book about France and the French dealing with myths and whether they're true or not. That came out in 2014 in the US, and it's still available. The next book, which is coming out in April this year, is called Ethics for France. And that's really a kind of, it's much more of a digested read than They Eat Horses. It's essentially a trivia book with lots of fun facts and information about the French that you may not even know or have heard of. And it's a sort of potted version of the They Eat Horses, which is a sort of more in-depth, if you like, study of myths, how they arose, whether they're true or not, so on and so forth. So the two books go quite well together. They're kind of both looking at France from a sort of cultural perspective, but Ethics of France is a much lighter read, and it's much more of a fun book, perhaps, than They Eat Horses.
Now, what, I guess, before we get into The Dead Duke, what got you into writing books? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I always loved English. That was my favorite subject ever since I was a child. I studied English at university. I loved writing from a very, very early age. I always knew that I wanted to be a writer, but in my sort of early years of working, I did practice as a lawyer and do various other things. And I think actually that was a good thing because on balance, writing in the end is about writing about one's experience and what you do, and therefore most writers actually, if you look at their careers, have done other jobs, because if you haven't done other jobs, you haven't really got much to write about. The idea that you sort of spend your whole life in this sort of garret writing is a bit of a misnomer. I think my main progression as a writer has been from my first book, my really, really first book, which I very rarely talk about, was actually an exploration in fiction. And I'm very glad I did it because it taught me and it showed me that fiction is just not my thing. I'm really a non-fiction writer. That's what I love. And in fact, I'm a non-fiction reader. I would much prefer to read non-fiction to fiction. And so that really set me on the right course after that to write nonfiction. And the two branches, if you like, of writing that I do, one is books about France and the French, because I've lived in Paris for a very long time now. And the other is quite different, but in some ways uses similar skills, and that's historical true crime, legal cases, famous legal cases, which I go and revisit and look at them in their context and try and find out a bit more, particularly solving any historical mysteries that might be contained within them.
Funny, because there was a period in my life where I decided I'm going to read some of the classics, some of the classic works of literature. And I spent a couple of years doing that, and I loved them. I loved them. I thought they were great, but there was something about it where when I was done, as much as I loved it, it was kind of like, I didn't really learn anything here, except maybe how to write, I guess maybe write well if I wanted to do any, because I wrote a book as well. So I felt that I got, I felt I got that out of it, but it always felt to me like when I read nonfiction, I feel like I'm learning something. And so I very rarely read fiction. I don't know if that's sort of the same thing with you, why you sort of are more into nonfiction, but that's kind of how it felt with me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I have to say I agree with you. I mean, my problem with fiction is often I feel that it's sort of very much sort of, it is about great writing and writing really well, but I find a certain element of pretentiousness in the style, and I'm not particularly interested really in writing just for the sake of writing. For me, as with you, I think from what you're saying is, you know, for me it's what do you learn about the world we live in, the people, the events. And, you know, that's what I love reading about. And to some degree, when I'm writing, half the joy for me of writing nonfiction is actually the research. Because every book that you write in nonfiction, or certainly every book that I write, involves an enormous amount of research. And you have to really enjoy that to write nonfiction well. Because if you don't enjoy the research, you're just not going to enjoy most of the process of writing the book. So for me, at least half of the process is not just the writing, it's actually the researching, it's finding out about this amazing country I live in, finding out about these amazing historical mysteries, trying to get to the bottom of what happened. And I agree, yes, and I what I particularly like in my narrative nonfiction, which is the historical stuff, is that, you know, I try and write it so it reads like a novel, like fiction, but at the same time it's true. So it might sound a bit arrogant. I think, you know, with really good narrative nonfiction, you can actually do better than fiction, because you can write something which is vivid, which recreates the past, which has a story, which holds the reader. But at the same time, it's actually correct. It's actually true. It's not just something you sat there and made up.
It's kind of funny because on this show, we talk to all sorts of people. We talk about every topic imaginable, including stuff like UFOs and aliens. And every now and then I'll have a scientist on the show, and they will say something to the effect of, it always amazes me that people are so interested in things like UFOs and aliens and conspiracy theories and that sort of thing, when if you really read about science, I mean, science itself is amazing. I mean, there are all these things that people want to believe that aren't true, and there's plenty of stuff that is true that's amazing, and I guess you could make the same analogy. I mean, you could read, I'll just give an example, Sherlock Holmes, a fictional story about crime. That's all well and good, but think about all of the great true crime stories that you could write about that are just as good, but they really happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm totally with you on this. I mean, that's exactly it. And The Dead Duke's a good case in point, because, you know, it really is a story which, when you research it, is absolutely incredible. And in fact, a few of the reviewers pointed out that if I'd written it as a novel, people would have said, this is ridiculous. You know, I mean, this is really far-fetched. This writer is just imagining ludicrous things. No one would believe it. And yet, actually, it's true. And in fact, the same is true of I'm researching a new true crime now, actually, which is set in California in the 1940s, so a very different world. But again, you know, the reality, the things that actually happened are beyond what anyone could imagine. And I think the trouble is there has been this movement in writing recently. There's been this obsession with fantasy, really. We started off, you know, we had all the J.K. Rowling, and now we've got the 50 Shades of Grey. And, you know, there is this obsession with fantasy writing, which is fine. I mean, I liked fantasy a lot as a child, but it kind of, to me, almost represents a withdrawal from reality, this kind of retreat into this world of imagination, of fantasy, and so on. And it's a bit of a shame, because if we actually look at the real world out there, it's got so much that's just unbelievable and incredible. I'm not sure we really need to retreat into these kind of, you know, into these worlds of the imagination, really. And I mean, I think the best nonfiction does that. The best nonfiction makes you, it revives your interest and belief in the incredibleness, the amazingness of the world that we live in.
The Dead Duke, His Secret Wife, and the Missing Corpse is what we're going to talk about here for a while. The Dead Duke is William John Cavendish, Cavendish Scott Bentinck, the 5th Duke of Portland. Is that right? I got all that?
Yeah.
Okay.
You did. Very good.
How? I once read, what was the book? The Devil in the Dark, or The Devil in the White City, I think it was.
Yes.
And
very good book.
Yes, very good book. And I remember at the time, it was sort of, when I read it by the end, it was like, how in God's name had I never heard about this before I read this book? And actually, there's plenty of books like that where you can't believe that you didn't know about this before because it seems like such a big deal. How did you get on the path to write this book?
Well, I was actually looking around for a new story to write about, and I was poking about a secondhand bookshop, which is one of my favorite ways of finding things, and there was this really tattered old volume. It was a 1970s collection of Victorian scandals, and I was just leafing through it, and they had a chapter on this Druce Portland case, and I remember looking at it, and it was this story, essentially, of how there was a real case at the end of the 19th century that centered around whether the 5th Duke of Portland, who was a notorious eccentric, had had a double life as a Baker Street businessman. And I looked at it and I thought, this is absolutely incredible. I can't believe this really happened. And that just triggered off my interest. I tend to find that with the narrative nonfiction, that there's a particular story or scenario which just triggers my interest. I'm not someone who, for example, I've got writer friends who just focus on a particular period. I've got a friend who only writes Victorian books on the Victorian times. I'm not actually like that. The Dead Duke is obviously a 19th century book. My present one, as I say, is California in the 1940s. It's a completely different scenario, but in each case, there's something in the story that really strikes me, and I just think, wow, that isn't it. I want to find out more about that. I really want to research that. There's a story there. There's a book that you can write.
Now, you mentioned that the Duke was eccentric, and that word can mean a lot of things, but this guy, he was, I don't even know how to describe him. Tell everybody a little bit about some of the crazy eccentricities of the Duke.
Yeah, the 5th Duke was probably one of the most notorious eccentrics in the 19th century. He was a famous recluse. He had a network of underground tunnels built beneath the family seat, which was Welbeck Abbey in Nottinghamshire. It was this huge, great, brooding abbey. It's, you know, like similar to Downton Abbey, probably even bigger. And he built this network of underground tunnels where he would just retreat for months at a time. He seemed to have been terrified of sunlight for some reason. It's believed he possibly had some kind of skin condition which made his skin very sensitive to the light. He hardly spoke to anyone. He would communicate with his butler through post boxes. There was a couple of post boxes at his door, one for letters in, one for letters out. He had his newspapers ironed before he would read them. He was so big about dirt. He wouldn't touch coins. He insisted that all the money was washed before he touched it. He had blinds in his carriage so he couldn't be seen. He was absolutely petrified of being seen by anyone. So he would disappear in his carriage with the blinds down. And he would go in, the carriage would drive through his underground tunnel to the station. It would be taken out of the station, put on the train, go down to London and be taken off. And that way the Duke could go all the way from Nottinghamshire to his London house without anybody seeing him. So he was quite an extraordinary person. And the fact that he disappeared for so long, 6 months of the year or more in these tunnels, meant that it was actually quite possible that he did have a double life. And probably one of the reasons why this case, was believed by so many people and went on for so long.
Did he become progressively more eccentric as time went on, or was he sort of always described in this manner?
He did become more eccentric. He was relatively normal when he was younger. He was always quite a shy person, quite a retiring person, but not as strange as he became when he was older. There's been a number of explanations posited for why he changed. He did actually have quite a severe carriage accident in his 20s where he struck his head on the spoke of a wheel of the carriage, and that could possibly explain that there was some form of brain damage which actually led to this behaviour. He also had a failed romance with a well-known singer of the time, a lady called Adelaide Kemble. It's possible that that turned his head somewhat. It's not really known why he became as mad as he did.
So you have this Duke, and he's got a reputation. He's very eccentric. He's got these underground tunnels. He doesn't want to talk to people. He doesn't want to be seen. And eventually, he dies. And I guess, actually, it was quite a while later, Anna Marie Drews comes forward with a wild claim. What did she say?
Well, yeah, exactly. Quite a while after he died in 1879, towards the end of the 19th century, just before the beginning of the 20th, a little old lady called Anna Maria Drews comes to the court and claims that her father-in-law, who was a very well-known Baker Street businessman called Thomas Charles Drews, was actually the 5th Duke of Portland in disguise. So in other words, the 5th Duke, when he disappeared into his tunnels, popped up in Baker Street in another life as a Baker Street businessman. In that life, he got married and had children. And that was the significance of her case, because everyone believed that the 5th Duke had died when he died in 1879 without being married, without having children. And therefore, the entire estate of Welbeck Abbey and what was then a large part of North London went to a very remote cousin of his who became the 6th Duke. But if what Anna Maria Drews said was true, and that actually the 5th Duke had had a second life as a Baker Street businessman, Thomas Charles Drews actually got married and had children, and therefore Anna Maria's son would have been the true heir to inherit the Portland millions. And of course, at this point, they were one of the richest families in the country. So that was the significance of the case. And whilst the 6th Duke, this is the cousin who'd officially inherited the dukedom, he made out he was not worried about this and that it was all a joke, but actually he took it very, very seriously indeed. And if you look at the contemporary documents, which I did, you see that he went to great lengths. He actually employed private investigators to investigate the case and try and discredit this claim, which dragged on for over a decade in the Edwardian courts. It was one of the biggest cases. It was one of the headline news items for the entire first decade, really, of the 20th century. It was equivalent to, I'm just trying to think of, you know, it's equivalent to O.J. Simpson or something like that at the time.
So again, she claimed that the Duke had faked his death and was now living as Thomas Charles Drews. And I guess the question is, tell us a little bit about what the documents of the time said about this Thomas Charles Drews, because from what you've told us about the Duke, it would seem to be very difficult for that guy to live a double life based on what we knew about him.
Not exactly. I mean, the 5th Duke, because he disappeared for long periods of time, it was not known what he did. So it was arguable that he could be living a double life. And there were certain strange parallels between the characters of the 5th Duke and T.C. Drews, which, of course, Anna Maria's lawyers really played on. Both men were very averse to eating red meat. They would only eat chicken or fish. And also very much averse to sunlight. Strangely enough, Thomas Charles Drews also had a phobia about going into the light. His office was surrounded by curtains, red velvet curtains that he had drawn for most of the day. So there were certain strange things that did link the two men and made it quite credible that they could actually have possibly been the same person.
And the real succeeding Duke, as you noted, was very concerned about this. I mean, do we know, how can I say this? Do you believe that he was really concerned that it was true, or that he was concerned people would believe it was true and he might lose his position, so to speak?
No, I think he really was concerned that it was true, because he knew very little. The sixth Duke knew very, very little about the fifth Duke. He hadn't even met him once when he was alive. The only time he ever saw him was on his deathbed. He came and paid his last respects when the fifth Duke had died. So he had never met him. He heard all these incredible stories. He knew that he was deeply eccentric. There's a brilliant extract from one of the contemporary memoirs, which I use at the beginning of my book, when the sixth Duke arrives for the first time at Welbeck, and he sees this huge abbey completely deserted. There are planks on the floor. The rooms are all painted pink and empty, save for one toilet in each room, which is completely exposed to full view. He sees this network of tunnels, and he's just absolutely flabbergasted at the craziness of it all, this kind of madness on a huge scale. So he knew very, very little, if anything, about the fifth Duke, and he was very, very concerned that these things might actually be true.
Now, did Anna Marie have, I don't know if an alibi is the right word, but why would the Duke, who essentially would have had it all, I mean, why would he have needed to lead a double life?
Well, I guess he was deeply eccentric, so his behavior was pretty peculiar, and therefore I think that was the explanation that, you know, I mean, he really didn't need to do half the things we know he definitely did do. He didn't need to construct 100 miles of tunnels beneath at Welbeck Abbey, a huge expense. Completely unnecessary, and in fact now most of them are boarded up. You can see a few of them just around the main part of the house, but the rest of them are all boarded up and just rotting away. So he clearly didn't need to do the tunneling, but he did. So whilst he didn't need to live a double life, maybe he did. The other point about the fifth Duke, which does feed into this, is that he was known to dislike members of his own class. He was not comfortable with aristocratic women and with social life, the kind of social life he was expected to lead. He was much happier with working class people, and in fact that's possibly one of the reasons he had all this building work. He actually enjoyed hanging out with the workmen. He felt more comfortable in a situation where he wasn't expected to be grand. So that could have explained him adopting another life and becoming a Baker Street businessman, because it would have been an escape from a world in which he never really felt very much himself, the aristocratic world.
So if we believe that these two were the same guy, essentially the Duke did not like to talk to any workmen. He did not like to talk to anybody. He did not like to be talked to. So as an escape, he would have become this T.C. Druce, and then he was fine talking to everybody because he did not have to, I guess, be the Duke, essentially.
Right.
Okay.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's quite clear that the fifth Duke was very, very uncomfortable with his role. He disliked high society. He disliked aristocratic women. He didn't like ceremony and dressing up and fashion. He didn't want to play the political role he was expected to play at that point, because at that point the Dukes of Portland were always involved in the political life of the country. He didn't want to do that. He was much, much happier insofar as he wanted to associate with anyone. I mean, he was basically much happier when he was just on his own in his library and his room doing whatever he was doing by himself. But if he had to be associating with anyone, he was happier to be with the servants and the people working on the estate.
So I guess the easiest way to describe this would be, if you were to believe that they were the same guy, we would presume that the Duke himself was in his right mind. He was just extremely uncomfortable with his role. Whereas if they were two separate people, we could conclude that perhaps the Duke was just completely out of his mind.
Probably, yes. Yeah, I guess you're right.
So Anna Marie, I don't know how much of this we want to reveal here. Obviously, you can go up on Amazon and grab the book, The Dead Duke, His Secret Wife and the Missing Corpse. She was involved in this case for a long time. I guess, as you noted, it was in the courts for a long time. And I guess at the end of the day, they locked her up.
Unfortunately, she did end up in a mental asylum. I don't want to go into the story too much because it will spoil it, particularly what happened when they actually, in the end, dug up the grave of T.C. Drews to figure out whether he was the Duke, whether there was even a body there. You know, we did actually finally get to this point at the end of 10 years when that happened. But Anna Maria Drews did go mad over the process, probably through, you know, all this endless process of litigation and courts. I mean, to some degree, it's sort of parallel to stories like, for example, Charles Dickens's Bleak House, which is, you know, a story of endless litigation, of courts, the courts of chancery, people fighting wills and cases and endless battles that drives everyone insane in the end.
So we won't spoil what happened when this case was solved, but we can say that if you read the book, you'll get your payoff there in the end. How about that?
Yeah, that sounds okay.
Now, I mean, this case is I'm sure one of I mean, you mentioned it was front page headlines. It was a huge story. I'm sure there are many people, probably the vast majority listening to this right now, unless they've read your book, they've heard absolutely nothing about this. Why are there, I guess it's just 120 years ago or 130, 140 years ago or whatever, but it does seem that sometimes there are very, very big stories, crime stories. We mentioned the Devil in the White City, that just as time goes on, no one hears about them anymore. Whereas a story about, for example, Jack the Ripper, who really, at the end of the day, and I don't want to downplay any of this, obviously, but we only know of 5 victims, and we still talk about it to this day. Why are some stories, I guess, eternal, and others just pass on until someone like you comes on to write about them?
I have to say, I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, I think certain cases just enter into the popular imagination for whatever reason, sometimes because they tap into a sort of collective anxiety or fear. To some degree, I think that's true of the Jack the Ripper story. I think it also very much helps that that's unsolved. You know, anything that's unsolved is always an unsolved mystery, particularly a murder mystery, is always going to hold the popular imagination. And I think, you know, it's interesting to have books on both subjects. It's interesting to have books which revisit mythic cases like Jack the Ripper. And it's interesting to have books that uncover hidden gems, things that everyone's forgotten about, but which actually are really very back to them. The Dead Duke is definitely the latter case. That's a case which was huge at the time, passed into oblivion, and which, you know, that book is probably, it is the only standard book now on that case, and it uncovers so much that's really interesting and fascinating that had been forgotten. The one I'm working on now is actually a huge story. I mean, probably on a par with the Ripper, and that's a kind of whole interesting set of challenges in itself. I mean, it's if you're writing a book on a big story like that, that kind of leads to a whole different set of issues and challenges of how you treat it, and you know, you have problems about, you know, how do you say something new? How do you, you know, carve your own niche? You also have to be very, very careful about your factual checking, because you know that a million other people will be going over all of this. So, you know, there's room for both types of book, I think, and they're quite different challenges to write.
Now, before we go, since you had mentioned that you're fascinated in these sorts of things, this is when we mentioned Jack the Ripper. That is a case that, I don't know, how many books do you think have been written on that? 1,000? Certainly,
oh, goodness.
A ridiculous number. Have you ever really taken a look at that case? I mean, do you have your own theory about Jack the Ripper, or no?
Well, I've read quite a few of the books on the case, because obviously this is generally historical. True crime is one of my areas of interest. Personally, I was actually quite convinced by a book called Naming Jack the Ripper, which came out, I think it was just over a year ago, and it was a book that caused a lot of controversy, because essentially it centered on this shawl, which was discovered and allegedly owned by the person who committed the murder, and it rested a lot on forensic evidence, the forensic analysis of the shawl. And in the end, you know, there were a lot of questions raised about whether that forensic evidence was correct or not. So personally, I actually think the author of that book made a pretty convincing case. And I think there was a concerted attempt to kill that case off, because there were a certain number of people who've got a vested interest in the thing remaining a mystery. There were too many people who've written books about it with their own pet theory. And I think to some degree, it's a case that's actually almost impossible to prove, because even if you came up with the evidence, there would be enough people in there who've got their own pet theories who would just knock you down and would refuse to accept it. But I know that since the book that I've read, the one naming that Jack the Ripper, there has been another book that's come out saying something completely different about it, saying it's all a Masonic conspiracy or something, which I haven't read that book, but I find that hard to believe. So, you know, it kind of proves the point that with these great unsolved mysteries, I actually think even if you had the DNA evidence in black and white that gave the answer, people would still carry on believing the latest story, because, you know, in the end, it's that kind of pull of what's unsolvable.
It is interesting, if you check out the book on Amazon, Naming Jack the Ripper, Edward Russell is the author. And it has got quite the mix of reviews. 5-star, 4-star, 3-star, 2-star, 1-star, everything. I mean, there are people that think this is the answer, and there are people that think that this is wrong. So, very controversial.
It caused a big stir. And I remember looking up on one of these Ripper websites when it came out, and one of these, they're called Ripperologists. You know, these people who specialize
yes.
in the Ripper said, we must knock this book down. This book is dangerous.
Wow.
Because, you know, and there was this whole discussion going on where, you know, they were actually, people were really afraid, because people have built their whole careers around their particular theory. They've built, you know, written books, they go to conferences. I mean, they're conferences. These people, you know, they go around these things all year. That's what they do. And that would be the end of, you know, the end of everything they'd built. So, I mean, as I say, I'm certainly not an expert. I'm definitely not a forensic expert, which, you know, to really evaluate that book, I think you've got to, you know, you've really got to have some kind of grasp on the forensic detail. But I felt that book was fairly convincing, really, just in terms of... it was just too many coincidences in that book. I mean, there's a well-known saying that detectives don't believe in coincidence. And once you get 3 or 4 all centering around one thing, it does set bells ringing. And it makes you think, hang on a minute, there may be something in this.
Very good reviews for your books on Amazon. Pew Marie Eatwell is our guest here today. The Dead Duke, His Secret Wife, and The Missing Corpse is the book that we were discussing regarding the 5th Duke of Portland. And the book about France, there's a few of them. The one that is out right now, They Eat Horses, Don't They? The Truth About the French. And you've got another one coming out in April, and you're working on another one about a true crime case in California. Want to give you a chance to plug everything here, what you've got coming, where people can find out more about you, read the books, etc.
I'm just trying to think. Now you've mentioned all the books. People can follow me on Twitter at QE12. I'm also on Facebook, Instagram. I'm on all the social media. And I, you know, I'm always very happy to interact with anyone who's read or got any comments on my books. I mean, that's again half the pleasure of writing, is when you get feedback from people.
Well, Pio, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and best of luck with the upcoming books. And hopefully, when you get them going, we'll have you back on again and talk about them.
Absolutely. You can tell me all the things that I've said and done wrong when I write about California in the 1940s.
That's right. I was not around, but I've heard about it.
No, sorry, I didn't want to imply that you were.
No. Well, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and we'll be back in just a moment, everybody, After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here for the final segment of the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Digital Network. Don't forget, we're here every single Sunday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. If you normally listen via podcast and want to listen live, you can do so on the TuneIn Radio app. That is the TuneIn Radio app. You can grab it in the App Store if you've got iTunes or whatever App Store you've got for your particular listening device. Head over there, grab the TuneIn Radio app, and then search Dark Matter Digital Network, and you can listen live to all of the great shows that are available every week on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Sundays, we usually do a doubleheader, myself, After Dark Radio, followed by Carl Stern's Dragon King Dark. If you miss one or both, you can always grab them as a free download for a week up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We got two shows up there right now. Carl's show, which is about to kick off here in a moment, talking the Sloss Furnace. And last week's After Dark Radio with Robin Hansen, talking about his upcoming book on robots, the future in our own lifetime, and so much more. That's up there right now at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Don't forget, all the contact information is up there as well. I am Brian Alvarez, at Brian Alvarez on Twitter. Brian at AfterDarkRadioShow.com is the email address. Everything you need is up there at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So as always, I want to thank Keith Rowland, the Dark Matter Digital Network, all of you, the callers and listeners. We will talk to you again next week with a brand new show, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.